You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, August 17th, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Eva Gollinger, attorney, activist, author of The Chavez Code. We're going to talk about what's happening in Venezuela now, the many sides of that conflict, the role that the U.S. is playing, upcoming election there, and why there's really no good side at the moment in Venezuela. And we'll also get back to some of the history and the accomplishments of Chavismo, as well as its failures, all that with Eva Gollinger. Donald Trump has always been, is now, and will remain a cheddar brain virulent racist. And he went out on another Twitter tantrum after he disbanded his council of advisors before they could all quit. Dangerous and disturbing times. Steve Bannon reached out to a liberal writer at the American Prospect and gave what apparently he did not think was an interview, but a interview nonetheless. He was speaking on the record. He didn't specify otherwise, which is
unfair.
And if this interview does not get Steve Bannon fired, it means that Steve Bannon has
the P-tape.
A P-tape himself of Donald Trump. He is literally in possession of that DVD. There was a recent, just as we were starting, apparently some sort of terrorist attack in Barcelona. A van rammed into several civilians. This literally just happened as we started. We might know more as the show goes on. Fallout continues. Donald Trump's robust racism. And we have a video of Republican commentator Star Parker comparing the rainbow flag for the rights of LGBTQ community to the Confederate flag. And Jeff Sessions says that sanctuary cities are the friend of human traffickers. John Bolton has a meltdown on North Korea. Why? Well, you guessed it. Some members of this demented administration are actually advocating a rational course of action, including, ironically, Steve Bannon. That was part of what will get him fired, is because in this conversation with Robert Kuttner, he actually said some things about North Korea, which were pretty sensible, including there is no military solution there.
What was he thinking?
What was he thinking? That's totally unfair.
That's not what MacArthur would say, Steve.
Steve, I thought you understood MacArthur. Out of the gate, I do want to thank everybody. I think this is the second show I've hosted since the launch of the Michael Brooks Show. Thank you, everybody who's checked it out. 541 patrons. If we reach 700 by the end of August, we get a matching donation, which would be amazing and very helpful. So if we can get up to 700... that would be incredible. The first idea primer for members came out last week. That was on a modern history of the Third Way. This Sunday, me and Gene Bajlan, who's a Middle East scholar, did a primer on Turkey's Twitter army and Erdogan's use of social media and suppression and the sort of new right neo-authoritarian strategy of social media, which you see everywhere from Trump to Modi in India. Last week on the public show, had on Jabari Brisport, who's a socialist candidate running for city council in Matteni's district in Brooklyn. 69 reviews on iTunes, a lot of people watching on YouTube. If you're a member or you're watching on iTunes, on YouTube, please subscribe to it on iTunes as well, because we want to get in front of more and more eyeballs. And this week, Anoa Changa And Sam Sachs from District Sentinel and Studio, the Michael Brooks Show. Thanks, everybody. You know, we're refining it. There's going to be more sketches, more clips, working out the format, but really excited about it. Super producer Matt.
People should check out the Jabari Brisport interview. We're eventually going to clip it for the Majority Report YouTube page, but you should go check it out on the podcast because he was a very impressive candidate.
Yes.
I made the joke to Michael, like, the centrists are going to be really pissed that they didn't get to him first because he's very polished. We played a clip of him on Fox News, basically sort of pointing out how ludicrous the equivalence between Antifa and fascism is. It was a very impressive interview. I enjoyed it.
Young people putting their bodies on the line to fight Nazis are somehow equivalent to Nazis. Only in the minds of Nazis, Fox News analysts, and deluded moronic centrists. Before we're going to get to This Morning in Tweets, which is a new segment that we're actually going to be doing regularly on the new show, or This Week in Tweets, unless, pray to God, this lunatic quits, which I doubt, but Jeffrey Schwartz has suggested he might. Or is it Jeffrey Schwartz? I don't know. It doesn't matter. Schwartz, his Tony Schwartz.
Ghostwriter.
His ghostwriter on Art of the Deal. But first I want to tell you about Breather. Sam had the opportunity to go check out the local Breather space, but it's an amazing concept. Every time you book a meeting or work event, there's a whole set of potential problems to consider. Where's the most convenient location? Will it feel professional? Will there be good Wi-Fi? Breather has a beautiful, inspiring workspaces for all of your offsite team meetings, client meetings, or even individual work. The best part, and this really is a crucial distinction in this whole kind of co-working space, you only pay for the time you need, a month, a day, or even just an hour. So anywhere where they have a location, which I'll get to in a moment, you can use this like that. Whether you want to do a writing session, therapists can use it, meetings, find a place to record something, all that stuff. It's incredible. There are no minimums or commitments with Breather. They own all their own spaces, so you get an excellent, consistent experience every time. Breather is in LA, New York, San Francisco, Palo Alto, Boston, Chicago, DC, Toronto, Montreal, London, and they're growing. Even Google, Apple, and Facebook employees use Breather for their offsites and team meetings, and they already have really nice offices. Don't overpay for your space you don't need. Book Breather space for the time you need and spend hundreds, not thousands. Try Breather right now, and you'll receive 100 off your first booking when you go to breather.com/majority. That's 100 off your first booking when you go to breather.com/majority. 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 Matt, at some point on the show, put a link on the blog post. I realize I neglected that. I'm sorry. So Donald Trump, when the events in Charlotte, Nazis rallied, there was a counter demonstration. A Nazi rammed his car into a group of people, killing one, injuring over 30 others. Donald Trump initially said there were violence on many sides. Then the following day, he must have been dressed down by one of his babysitters, and he sort of finally, in this very strained way, condemned the haters, Klan, and neo-Nazis. Then the next day, when we played it yesterday, had a full meltdown, said there were good people on all sides, and called out the alt-left for being violent, and then said, where does it end? Washington owned slaves. Jefferson owned slaves. And here he is in tweets from this morning. This is just an hour ago. I mean, he's really, this might even be before his first KFC snack of the day. He is having an absolute meltdown. And does it start? Okay, it starts in the bottom. Sad to see the history and culture of our country being ripped apart with the removal of our beautiful statues and monuments. These are monuments and statues to Confederate terrorists who opposed, in fact, the creation of the modern version of this country, worth noting, and fought a battle on behalf of slavery. And by the way, like, let's be really clear. There isn't a sort of cute, you know, there's complexity to the Civil War, obviously. But make no mistake, the kind of general popular understanding that slavery was a core issue and what they were fighting about was in fact the case. Not from like a Northern human rights perspective. Obviously, Northern states still, you know, extraordinary levels of racism and white supremacy. But it was an economic battle, and the South's economy was built on just on human bondage. I mean, people really need to think about that. There's nothing antiseptic about this. Systemic rape, murder, torture, and enforced labor. Every grotesque thing you could imagine. Sad to see the history and culture of our country being ripped apart with the removal of our beautiful statues and monuments. You, and this is the next one, can't change history, but you can learn from it. Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, who's next? Washington, Jefferson, so foolish. Now, I said on my show that I, particularly Jefferson, is hard to historicize. He was, even by the standards of his day, a truly obscene guy. So even as an example, I mean, it sounds, you know, weird to say, and none of it's exculpatory, but, you know, Washington freed his slaves. How big of him when he passed away. Jefferson, when he passed away, made sure they were sold. Being that as it may, I mean, Sam pointed this out. Statues are also not sort of literal representations of individuals. It's also about what they represent.
They weren't put up by historians.
Right. And Washington represents the founding of this country, not a Southern slave state. And Jefferson also wrote, you know, in spite of his, you know, hideous behavior and beliefs, obviously wrote movingly, you know, a logic of universal human rights, which could be turned against him because they apply to all humans. That's what we're honoring. Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson were fighting again against the creation of the modern United States and for the preservation of slavery or states' rights. Also, the beauty that is being taken out of our cities, towns, and parks will be greatly missed and never be able to be comparably replaced. Well, I, for one, sure hope they're not comparably replaced. It's always been obvious, first and foremost for Donald Trump, is his various emotional and mental issues and problems and resentments and narcissism and tantrums and sociopathy and stupidity and greed and scam artistry. But if he does have a consistent instinct towards anything, going back to his father and him, you know, screening out tenants, to mind-bogglingly stupid comments he made in the 80s about who he wanted, about wanting Jews to handle his money, about how being an educated black would be a big advantage. Central Park Five. He said... with regards to what happened in Charlottesville with white supremacist alt-right Nazi terrorism, that he watched it more closely than the press and he needed to get all the facts. Whereas in the 80s, he took out a front page ad calling for the death penalty, reinstatement of the death penalty, to kill some teenagers of color who have all been exonerated, even though they had their lives ruined, because he was part of the racist mob that blamed them for that horrific attack in Central Park in the late 80s. To the extent there's anything that's consistent besides his bloviating stupidity and narcissism, it's his bigotry. And anybody, and by the way, standing by it is not Mitch McConnell saying there's no such thing as good Nazis. Standing by it is anybody in Congress not saying we need to evoke 25th Amendment or get this guy out of office immediately or demanding he resign. If you're not doing that, you're complicit in it. We'll be right back with Ava Gullinger on the Majority Report. We
I so why should I be afraid of you when you bleed just like I do? The more you try fight, judge a light keeps shining through. So I've got no time for you, cause in my view you wanna step in on my shoe. You wish you never leave a loo and feel so damn confused. How every day you wake you ache because you know you're fake, and every step you take I bring you closer to your grave. But I am like a column when I easily shake. Me certain say I feel me none of who no can take. We guided by the monster defender of the faith. Yes, ordained to be great. Oh, them a bad bite us. Hypocritical, two-sideless. We call them modern day Judas. The spreaders of rumors. Oh, them a bad bite us. Hypocritical, two-sideless. We call them modern day Judas. Spreaders of rumors. But your teeth and tongue gonna let you down. Reward for your words shall be profound. Oh, screw all you want, but go loo and drown.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Ava Gollinger. She's an attorney, activist, and award-winning author of The Chavez Code. Ava, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So you have a really kind of long experience and background in Venezuela. We're going to talk about the crisis that Venezuela is in today and the sort of many different factors contributing to it. But I think that, you know, Chavez and Chavismo has kind of become, and this could just reflect my own biases, I think, and I'll sort of lay them out really briefly. I think that there was real accomplishments, real failures. It might not have been a project that was durable, but it's become a shorthand for some people that want to ignore U.S. behavior that continues in Latin America, and also a stand-in for why you can never have a real kind of left politics that redistributes wealth and handles resources fairly. And then on the other hand, there's a contingent of people that, you know, want to blame essentially the United States for the ever, you know, for sort of every failing that has sometimes been totally self-generated in this project. You know, worked with Chavez. You had experience kind of going back to the beginning when he first came into power. And I just would like if you could reorient us to him and the initial project beyond these kind of generic characters that we have in the press here.
Sure, and even going back further, before Chavez was first elected president, which was in 1998, I first went to Venezuela in the early 1990s because of a family connection, and 1993 to be precise. That was a time period of incredible turmoil in the country. I mean, it's ironic because it seems like a lot of it has come full cycle, although it's different for different reasons today. But back then, you know, the country, Chavez himself, as a lieutenant colonel in the army, had just led a military rebellion or attempted coup against, at the time, Carlos Andres Perez, who was a member of one of the ruling parties in the country, was serving a second term as president, non-consecutive, and was incredibly corrupt and had been charged with impeachment. And before, just a few years before, in 1989, when there had been massive uprisings in the streets of Venezuela against austerity measures that this president had promised he wouldn't enact. And that's how he got elected. And then, of course, he did that. So there was this massive uprising, strikes, riots, everything. And what that president at the time did was order the troops out in the streets to literally massacre the people. Over 3,000 people were killed in 1989 in what was known as the Caracaso. It's a big Caracas explosion. One of the first sort of popular uprisings against neoliberalism and, you know, globalization, austerity measures. So Chavez sort of rode in on that, you know, going out against a corrupt, murderous administration that then, you know, he failed in that coup that he led. He went to prison for a couple of years until he was later pardoned by a subsequent president. But during the period when I first got there, that's what was happening. Mm-hmm. And that government, what happened was that president was going to, well, they don't have the same model of impeachment. He was forced to resign, fled to Miami, where he lived until he died a few years ago, with the wealth that he stole from the country. Mm-hmm. And the economy plummeted. I mean, it was just a nightmare. Inflation, you know, the currency devaluing and just chaos. And but beyond that, at that time, the government imposed complete restrictions of human rights. In fact, no, I mean, as like a national decree, no guaranteed civil rights, human rights, you know, no freedom of expression, no freedom of assembly. There was a national curfew imposed. There was a forced military draft in a country with no, you know, like military enemy. It was just sort of a way of controlling the people and mainly the poorer people. So, I mean, that's sort of how I got inaugurated into Venezuela, was in a time period of a lot of turmoil and crises. And so Chavez, when he was pardoned in 1994 under a new president who was still from one of the sort of traditional parties, he began to build this movement. It took 4 years, but he crossed the country, built a movement that was aimed at eradicating corruption, breaking this reign of two parties that ruled the country for over 40 years since the last dictatorship in 1958. And then also, you know, redistributing the oil wealth of the country. Oil was nationalized in 1976. It wasn't Chavez who did that, you know, but the country was running like a private corporation and there was 80% poverty. I mean, so he was elected in 1998 on a new party that he created, you know, a new movement that was aimed at eradicating corruption and poverty and redistributing the wealth and, you know, looking more towards social justice. He wasn't per se declared leftist or radical. I mean, he was a military man, but he did have that sort of discourse, more nationalist, more focused on equality, on the country's independence, on the country gaining control of its own resources and using them for the benefit of the people. Mm-hmm. And so that's what people saw in him. And then he had this project of the Constitution. You know, he was elected on this platform of, we need to rewrite our constitution. This is a constitution that, you know, was done by this political elite after the last dictatorship in 1958, and it doesn't reflect the true reality of our country. So he was elected with a majority to do that. Then it went to a popular referendum. People voted, you know, like overwhelmingly 80% or so, 70-80% to rewrite a constitution. Then they elected the people to do it. Then it was done in this really open way. And that's how I sort of got back involved, was in this process. I was in law school at the time when they were writing this constitution. It was just, it was a pretty incredible process to witness, you know, like a whole country of people writing a constitution. It ended up having 350 articles and addressing all areas of human rights. I mean, it's one of the more advanced constitutions in the world in that sense. So, you know, originally that was the movement Chavez was leading. He was able to unite a lot of social movements, unions, leftist parties, you know, that had been divided, similar as they have been in the U.S., for example. And so his leadership was able to sort of bring them all together. And those were the beginning years, was rewriting this constitution, you know, sort of getting things in order, enacting laws to guarantee that the oil wealth would be redistributed into social programs and focus on, you know, bringing people's quality of life up, which is really what happened initially with that movement. And, you know, it wasn't until he began directly affecting, you know, U.S. interests and elite interests in his early years. Because, you know, in the end, Venezuela, one of the reasons why it's important for people to understand that background somewhat is because Venezuela had long been a client state of U.S., you know, even before the democracy began in 1959, but it became a client state more so in the 70s and 80s and 90s, in the sense that U.S. corporations were running their oil industry, you know, the
what's
government.
What's the primary oil, sort of U.S. oil company operating in Venezuela?
Well, now it's Chevron, but okay. Chevron's the only one that stayed. It used to be Exxon.
Okay.
Exxon was the big one, and Exxon actually left the country in a big dispute in 2007 when it was discovered that Venezuela's largest oil reserves were this very heavy crude in the southeastern region of the country in the Orinoco River Basin that the U.S. the United States had originally classified as bitumen, which is like a very heavy coal, not oil. Mm-hmm. So it didn't qualify under the 1976 laws in Venezuela of nationalization. And so it was like a free for all in that area that the U.S. corporations were controlling. Once, you know, Chavez figured out, wait a minute, that's actually oil. That's not bitumen. It's just a very heavy crude. It was then subjected to the nationalization laws. And Exxon fought it. They wouldn't agree. And I mean, we're not talking about like the Venezuelan state goes in and takes everything. It had to be 51% ownership Venezuela, 49%, you know, foreign company. So it was still a really good deal. They would have to pay royalties and taxes on the profits. But otherwise, you know, but Exxon said, no way, because this was ours. We're not giving any of it up. And if we have to give any of it up, we're out of here. And so they left.
Right.
And then they sued Venezuela. I mean, that's right. Important because also, you know, who is the Secretary of State in the U.S. today is the former CEO of Exxon. So there's a longstanding adversarial relationship. Yeah.
Right. So
it's important.
It's very important. There's two other kind of table setting questions, though. And one is... one is another piece of history that people need to contextualize this, and the other is kind of a little bit more skeptical, I guess, going back to Chavez and his time. But the other really important thing that I just would like you to also explain is, in addition to these disputes, there was also a coup. I think it was in 2002, I believe, maybe 2003. Was it 2002?
No, 2002.
2002, yeah. Which, you know, clearly the Bush administration supported. Also, the New York Times humiliated itself by supporting. Chavez actually was returned to power very quickly, and the troops, the sort of like normal Venezuelan troops, were kind of not on board with it, and seemed like most people were still very committed to his project. Could you just briefly explain that history as well? Because I just think it's important that people know that, like, literally... There was a coup in modern Venezuela. It just didn't work.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, I was getting there with my little introduction. But
yeah, go.
So it was really after the new first, you know, that constitution was ratified by a popular referendum in 1999, in December of 1999. They had new elections under the new constitution. Chavez won again and was, you know, inaugurated as president again in 2000. And then began, under the new constitution, implementing laws. You know, they began legislating under that constitution, and some of it was land reform. Some was just hydrocarbons laws that, you know, began to affect the foreign companies, mainly U.S., again, because they were requiring them to pay royalties and taxes that previous governments had just looked the other way on because they were enriching themselves with, you know, bribery and whatever commissions they were taking. So those began to affect interest. And Venezuela took over the presidency of OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, of which it's a founding member. And when Venezuela took over, it was $7 a barrel in 2001. Under Chavez's leadership, it went up to $25 a barrel. So that began to affect, of course, U.S. consumers, companies. And then, of course, there was his discourse began to radicalize more. He opposed Bush administration's idea of expanding NAFTA into the Americas with a free trade of the Americas agreement. You know, he was outspoken against that. He began to ally with, you know, Cuba. I mean, not as close at the time, but still, there were things happening where it showed that Hugo Chavez was not subordinate to Washington, whereas other presidents in Venezuela had been. There were behind the scenes. I mean, I knew him really well, so I know a lot of what went on.
And he also wasn't trying to kind of synthesize like the way Lula maybe was, where he was trying to do a kind of center-left platform and have left alliances, but also not piss Washington and IMF off. Chavez was definitely going on a more kind of adversarial track with regards not to, you know, United States citizens, but to United States interests and corporate and government.
He wanted to have a good relationship, but in his eyes, it was, look, we're a country that has a lot of potential. You know, we're a major oil exporting and producing country. We want to be treated on equal grounds. And he wanted, you know, he had this sort of vision of the founder of Venezuela, Simon Bolivar, the liberator of you know, sort of realigning all the region, creating the Patria Grande, the grand, like, homeland in Latin America, the independence and sovereignty of the region instead of it being the backyard of the U.S. So, yeah, I mean, he was blunt, and he never hid under any kind of diplomatic language how he felt about that. So he became a target, and it was combined with the Bush administration backing this traditional elite in Venezuela. They attempted a coup against Chavez, and it lasted 48 hours. They took him out of and had him sequestered on an island and off the coast of Venezuela. And whether he was going to be killed or not or flown elsewhere, you know, we'll never fully know. But in that interim period, the opposition, many of whom continue to be the leadership today of the opposition in Venezuela, dissolved the constitution, all the established branches of government. It became a dictatorship. They persecuted Chavistas in the streets. People, over 100 people were killed. You know, it became very brutal and a reminder sort of Latin America's dark history of U.S.-backed dictatorships. And people said, wait, whoa, whoa, we're not going to let this happen. Are you nuts? Like, this is not happening here. So, and then, of course, the armed forces were loyal to Chavez. Mm-hmm. So they came out, and together with the people, millions flooded into the streets. You know, it became clear that people were not backing the coup. But in the interim, the Bush administration came out and supported it. You know, Ari Fleischer, who was the White House spokesman at the time, came out and, you know, gave this whole false storyline. So did CNN, all these different media outlets, New York Times, as you said, you know, all applauding it, saying Chavez resigned, he ordered the killings of his people and stepped down. I mean, it was all a plot. That's what my first book is about, The Chavez Code, that I uncovered these documents using Freedom of Information Act that show how deeply involved the CIA was, the Pentagon, as well as State Department through funding via USAID and National Endowment for Democracy, funneling millions of dollars into the groups that prepared and executed the coup against Chavez. And so then after that coup failed, he was brought back to power. He forgave everybody. You know, there was this like period of reconciliation. Then the opposition tried it again through strikes and, you know, other means throughout the years. Attempts continued.
Yes. I mean, okay. So I think that that's, again, that's important context for people. And we got to get to the present day pretty soon. But I mean, and again, this is my read of it. I'm curious. Was the experience under Chavez like there were contradictions in multiple tracks? So on one hand, there was this incredibly progressive constitution, which actually now seems like it's being potentially toyed with by Maduro. There was a really progressive constitution. There was serious reforms and there were some cuts in poverty and some delivery for people that had never been delivered for under, obviously, either a military junta or the two traditional Venezuelan parties. But then there was also, you know, the sense that Chavez, you know, he definitely was winning elections. And I don't think up until under Maduro there's ever been any credible allegations. And people always said that Venezuela under Chavez was stealing elections, but that was never credibly documented as far as I understand. At all. But there was a sense that maybe he had some kind of authoritarian leadings, that there was also the policy design. Like, if you're, you know, building programs, of course the oil wealth needs to go to the people, but are you structuring it in such a way that it's sustainable? Or in some ways, are you just riding a commodity boom like other governments ride commodity booms and doing it in a better way because you're delivering it with people, but at the same time, it's not durable and sustainable in the future? I guess what I'm just trying to say is before the wheels really start to come off, and clearly there's still a U.S. role there, and I want to also see if there are different parts of the opposition that we could start to disaggregate, and maybe also different parts of Chavismo now too. But were these problems that have been accentuated, whether they're economic management or the government responding in kind on human rights and suppression, were those already evident in certain ways under Chavez as well?
There was certainly a period of time that, you know, was sort of the heyday of the movement, which was from the time he was reelected in 2006 with like 62% of the votes, was pretty landslide victory.
Right.
And oil was growing, you know, to, it was in the, I don't remember, $60 or $70 a barrel. I mean, it was going up. Poverty was being eradicated. The social programs were expanding. The state apparatus was expanding. You know, everything was sort of falling into place in the region. Latin American countries were electing leftist presidents. They were aligning. They were creating regional organizations. They were all standing up against, you know, the Bush administration. I mean, it was just sort of, it was a pretty positive moment for a lot of the region.
It's kind of the political hope of the world at that time.
Yeah. I mean, and what was happening in Venezuela was successful or seen as successful at that time, because those, you know, poverty really was being eradicated. People really were learning how to read and write. You know, the medical system, free universal health care, was servicing millions and millions of people, and it was successful. I mean, it was, everything seemed to be going well and progressing. And, you know, then oil spiked at the $100 a barrel, and, you know, Venezuela began spending even more lavishly, even throughout the region, Caribbean nations giving away oil essentially, and spending on a lot of stuff, like spending, you know, a lot of the money that was coming in, and budgeting in even more programs in the country. So, you know, there, I mean, some ways I think that there, even though they always kept the budget to like $60 or $70 a barrel, even when it was at $100, there was still overly excessive spending. And even though Chavez did have a vision of diversifying the economy, of investing more in domestic production of, you know, other industries and in infrastructure, still it became overly dependent once again on the oil. And none of those other achievements were ever, you know, ever even came close to being successful. And then the corruption began to set in again. I mean, there's always been corruption there, but it became, you know, they would nationalize a certain industry or company for X reason, and then take it over. The state would take it over, be given to whoever to be in charge, and then it would just fall to pieces, because either, you know, one of the parallels I see in some ways to things happening in this country is that there was a big emphasis on loyalty and less on competence. And so a lot of people in the government were loyalists.
Right.
They weren't experienced or competent. And so that became clear as the years went by that things were not sustainable or successful, because there were no economists in the government.
And also, that instead of, at a smaller level, there was some real experimentation with like giving and devolving power to communities, but there was like the failure of, okay, if we're basically just going to have like a modernized Latin American social democracy, you need to have real professionals who manage it, part of the management team, and that can't just be loyalists. And then on the other hand, if you're going to do real radical experimentation with who owns things and how, you know, like worker cooperatives or how things are managed, then they can't just be part of a new political patronage network that's handed off to party loyalists and local bosses.
And that's what happened.
Right.
Because some of those were really cool ideas and amazing things that, you know, we all were interested in and wanted to succeed, but then you would see what would happen. Actually, it would be an amazing moment when something started and they were provided resources and Chavez would be there for the inauguration, and then, you know, a week later everything would fall apart because there was all this hype around creating it and making a big deal about it and using it sort of as propaganda, but then it didn't work. And but that's not across the board. I mean, there are a lot of community councils and community-based groups in Venezuela, you know, that are self-sustaining or try to be and are honest and, you know, trying to actually do that in a successful way and are not corrupted. But unfortunately, it became a closer circle. And then as Chavez became more entrenched in power as the years went by, and then once, of course, he became sick, then things really closed up, and the closest group around him also became the most corrupt. And it was, you know, some say, I mean, I can't say that he's devoid of any responsibility. He must be. But, you know, having been close to him and been there, I mean, I can say, at least from my experience, that I never saw any corruption on his part. But I certainly did see it amongst others close to him, mm-hmm. that some that he knew about and removed from his inner circle, but didn't, you know, put them in a position where they would be actually punished mm-hmm. or brought before justice. So then those people came back. And I mean, that's a lot of who's in power today.
Yeah, that's
people
Wall
that actually
Street,
he
right?
moved out. Yeah. He's now are back.
Okay,
you know,
so bring us to today, because I think it was in 2013 he passed away. Nicolas Maduro came into power. Maduro, you know, definitely just on a kind of basic level does not have Chavez's, you know, charisma or, you know, his, again, you know, just his credibility of his sort of establishing a political movement. My understanding is that when Maduro first was kind of written about, and maybe this is just a kind of generic American press response to, you know, any successors, like maybe he's more of a diplomat, which could be code for, you know, maybe he'll give Exxon its crude back or whatever. But things have really, really obviously gone in a very bad direction. And I want you to kind of explain the specifics of what's happening now with this constitutional assembly, how Maduro has failed, but then we'll also expand it to what the opposition movement really looks like. And I just want to stipulate, not as a specific question, but both when we talk about the opposition and the government and the Chavismo movement, it's very interesting to me. You mentioned before that there are still, you know, local councils that are actually successfully implementing progressive local programs. To the extent to which you can draw distinctions inside the opposition or inside the government or inside the Chavismo movement, like as an example, these people in the opposition are fed up with Maduro and the government and its failings and its corruption and the fact that all the indicators are sliding back in the wrong direction in terms of poverty and crime, but they might actually be open to at least a, you know, center-left agenda versus, hey, these are the same people that implemented the coup and they're just back out on the streets mm-hmm. and they just want to reconstitute oligarchy. And then the same with the government. If the elite is run by old, you know, people that Chavez, in fact, got rid of, and they're running a giant patronage network, and it's clearly not working, and Maduro's putting his family in different positions of power. But if there are still people on the grassroots that want to preserve the purpose of this movement, and there's internal conflicts on both of these sides, I think that's always, you know, sort of useful to know about and make those sort of distinctions. But anyways, get us back to, you know, I gave you a lot there, but how did things go off the rails with Maduro, and where are we now?
I would say it's somewhat surprising because, I mean, people may have seen him as a diplomat because he was the foreign minister for 6 years under Chavez. Mm-hmm. But, of course, he's from the working class. He was a bus driver, union organizer, right. You know, not someone from that traditional elite. So I think that's the main reason why Chavez sort of chose him as who could replace him when he died. And, you know, Maduro was elected by an extremely slim margin compared to what Chavez always got. I mean, less than 2 points, but still a lot of politicians are elected that way in the United States all the time.
Certainly.
So he still won. I mean, it was questioned by the opposition, but they question every election that they lose. And in any case, he was never given the same legitimacy that Chavez had had. And so that it got off to a bad start. But in any case, I mean, he was someone who seemed to identify more with this sort of grassroots movement. So it was interesting to see how it changed over the years. I mean, I think the first 2 years, it was more him sort of trying to get his bearings and figure out what to do because it wasn't something he was prepared for. And then with that, you know, crisis of legitimacy, the opposition protesting because they did that initially as well. People died, you know, it was violent. And then having to deal with the increasing economic crisis, which he then, you know, horrifically mismanaged, horrifically. And he, the people who were in government, who were sort of the more experienced, intellectual, capable, competent, left the government, the ones who were with Chavez, because they started to see things happening that they didn't like, which is what we're seeing now. You know, a lot more of the corruption and that nepotism and secrecy. A lot of, he's very opaque. Mm-hmm. Sort of the way that he manages his government is done by an inner circle of loyalists, and they have a lot of interests of their own in that. And so, and he also comes from this, he belongs to some tradition of spirituality of like Sai Baba or some, I don't know, no judgment, but you know, it's, there's a lot.
He's a devotee of Satya Sai Baba, really?
Him and his wife.
Oh wow, that's interesting. Yeah. Huh. Okay.
Yeah. There's a lot
I don't judge Indian spirituality, but I do judge Sai Baba.
Well,
I'll make that distinction.
It's a cult.
Yeah, it's a cult. Right, exactly.
Yeah. So there's that angle that just adds to his own sort of oddness in that position and what was going on. And in any case, you know, it things got worse and worse as the economy really, you know, sort of plummeted, because that's really what most people care about is their survival every day. And so he was unable to address that. And it actually got worse and worse. And the people he brought in to sort of help with that did a terrible job, you know, and things worsened. And so as that happened, instead of him looking for a way out that could have been more diplomatic, even though he did try, he reached out to the opposition to dialogue. It was just that the opposition leadership, and this will go to the second part of your question, the opposition leadership, you know, they're like a coalition of over a dozen political parties from a diverse ideological spectrum, and they don't agree on anything except regime change. Hmm. And so they all, you know, struggle amongst themselves for power and who's going to be the one who's going to take over. So Maduro reached out to that leadership, but of course that leadership only believes in regime change. So they weren't really willing to dialogue or negotiate on much. And so it never got anywhere. And then the legitimacy crisis worsened as the economy got worse. So, and as that happened, he started to change. I mean, I say this, I know him really well. So I was really surprised, even just over the past year and a half, he became way more sort of detached from the reality and more sort of entrenched in this idea that he inherited the leadership. Chavez gave it to him. He's the son of Chavez. That's how he calls himself. And so therefore he's righteous in whatever he does. And that's how it must be. And anyone else who strays from that is a traitor. You know, it's treasonous to even criticize. And that became more and more. But I mean, I think a lot of that is wrapped up in this, in the fact that they have a lot of interests as well, economic, you know, there's corruption in his inner circle that's really, you know, widespread and borders on, you know, like criminal organized crime. So, I mean, there's
like connections with the trafficking world, like kind of more of that type of thing too.
I don't have evidence of that, so I can't exactly say that, but yeah. I do. I have seen other things. So okay. I definitely know that there's, you know, extortion network. I mean, there's all kinds of ugly things that go on, and which I'm sure go on in any major oil producing country, because there's just too much money. There's just too much money coming into the state, and people can't help themselves with the greed. So, you know, it became, it's a very greedy inner circle there. But at the same time, I don't believe that it's fully malicious. I mean, I do, knowing him, I believe that he really honestly thinks that he has to carry on this project and defend Chavez's legacy, even as it's being destroyed by the policies that he's, you know, implementing and this sort of overall way he's carrying things out and the people amongst him. So, you know, as things just worsened in the country and this year, well, actually, December 2015, there were elections for the legislative body, and the opposition took a major majority that was completely unexpected for the government, because they didn't believe what was happening in the country. Mm-hmm. They were so detached from reality. They didn't see the discontent as being real. So when that happened, they freaked out and thought, whoa, 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 you know, we've lost power of our legislative branch of government. This is huge. And so they made sure they stacked the Supreme Court with complete loyalists that would serve their agenda no matter what. And it's a different legal system. So the court, the high court there has all these different powers that like our Supreme Court doesn't have. So their Supreme Court like nullified some of the legislative bodies, the parliament's powers. They did everything they can to basically neutralize the opposition in the parliament, which drove the opposition nuts. And so then they started all these protests that began last year and then this year spiked. And so once the street protests took off and became extremely violent, then the government, it was out of control. They were anarchical. Even the opposition couldn't control what was going on. Over 100 people were killed. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it went on for months. The country was at a standstill. The economy was still crashing. They were losing international legitimacy amongst, you know, a lot of countries, not all. And so that's where this idea came from of, okay, let's do something else. Let's rewrite the Constitution. And so, which to me sounded,
it's a great accomplishment. Why would you toy with it?
Exactly. Right. And well, I mean, the only justification was for them to essentially be able to fully nullify the parliament.
Okay.
And well, to ensure, because they wouldn't win another election at this stage. Maduro's up for, there's presidential elections next year. He would not win. You know, the government party would not win at this moment. So this was sort of a way for them to regroup and rally the base again, because, I mean, it is a grassroots process, even though there's the elite leadership of the government. Party loyalists are the ones running the whole show. There are grassroots people involved and community organizations, and they feel like they're participating. And even as the economic crisis continues, people feel again sort of active and involved, whereas they were feeling more detached. So it was a smart way to rally the base and get people involved in something they feel like they're participating in or going to have an impact on, even if that's not the case. And then it was a way to neutralize the opposition entirely, because now if for the first time there may have been fraud in an election, which was only to inflate numbers, not actual process fraud, but to inflate the numbers to make it seem like they have more votes. Now, you know, the opposition is saying they're going to participate in the next electoral process, which is now set for October, as decided by this, you know, constitutional assembly that's in power in the country now. And the opposition is going to participate in elections for governors coming up. So now they're basically legitimizing the electoral process again in order to participate so that they don't lose, you know, their regional seats of government, which they may or may not lose anyway, because there's all kinds of maneuvering going on. I mean, on one hand, again, the opposition doesn't agree on their candidates. It's not like they all want the same candidate for government or for president or any role. So now they're all promoting their own candidates. And then on the other side, the government-controlled elections council that oversees elections is busy nullifying candidates and parties from the opposition for all various kinds of reasons. And then you have this new supreme power in the country, which is rewriting the Constitution, even though they haven't even begun to rewrite a Constitution. They're just decreeing things against the opposition. That's what they're doing, essentially, is that they're now saying they're going after anyone who promoted the protest in the country, or basically any kind of dissent. They're going to either be prohibited from running for office, or they're going to be jailed. And they're completely backed by the Supreme Court, which actually in Venezuela is functioning as though it's a criminal court. They're jailing people.
Right.
You know, they're ordering arrests of you know, opposition and critics in the country. So that's what's happening now. I mean, there are still, though, just adding quickly, I know that there's too much information, but
no, it's fine. Go ahead.
There are still, you know, grassroots movements, there are community organizations, there are, you know, unions. I mean, there's sort of still that base that is not corrupted, but that says, well, the alternative is worse because we don't want the fascists back in power. So we're stuck with, you know, the corrupt, like, party, you know, loyalists that are in power, but at least they may be doing things that, you know, people disagree with on some ends, but at least the policies they're pursuing are still policies that are favorable to that grassroots base and to the majority of, you know, well, it's hard to say majority these days, but
I think so.
Sort of more social justice policy. I mean, they're trying to maintain social programs, healthcare, education, you know, job programs, housing, subsidized food. You know, they're trying to maintain those programs, which are widely popular in the country. So it's either that or the alternative would be neoliberalism and austerity and privatization, which is a return to the past.
So they need to find some opposition figure that can, like, Lula it, if it's possible at the moment. But
so far there isn't anybody
like that, right?
Not who has any kind of potential popularity at this time. Right. Anyone on the who's come out of Chavismo, who's critical of the government, has been labeled a traitor.
I see.
And even though there is a movement, very small, of, you know, the critical Chavistas, as they call them, it would be hard for them to garner power on a national level. I mean, there are some who are trying, but they're all being persecuted by the government.
It's always those guys. Like, I remember looking in Nicaragua and, you know, Ortega, also, like, just incredibly flawed leadership and even alliances with the right-wing opposition there at times. And the most compelling criticisms of him came from, like, you know, the real Sandinista movement, which went nowhere. But they were the ones that were right about everything. It's depressing.
Right. And exactly. What's happening internally there in the Chavista movement is that people who do criticize, including myself, you know, you're then immediately either labeled traitorous or persecuted, or, you know, the other people who agree with your criticism say, wait, don't do that, because you're giving the opposition ammunition against us. You know, you're justifying what they're doing or what the U.S. is doing by Trump saying now there's a military option, or, you know, Vice President Pence going, you know, he's in Latin America this week, going around trying to build an alliance against Venezuela to push for regime change. So, you know, it's this, are you with us or you're against us? I mean, there's no middle ground in Venezuela. And then on the opposition side, there none of those leaders who lead the parties that comprise the opposition coalition, none of them present any kind of real alternative. They're all either also corrupt or self-interested, or, you know, there's no, at this moment in time, there's not someone I could point to and say, there he is or there she is.
Right.
But, you know, that's how Hugo Chavez came about. And it took him 4 years to build a movement. And he came about from the people being fed up and sick of corruption and an elite running the country into the ground. And so that's how his leadership
was
born and supported. So,
well, here we are. And so,
who knows?
And just as a final, really 30-second thought, I mean, it's very important, I think, for those of us on the left to have a rigorous, honest, kind of broad-based conversation about this. But, you know, you've got the oil curse, which is always there. Maybe we'll save that for another conversation. But from the perspective of being in the United States right now, I think that we should not have any kind of naive support or justification of this present Venezuelan government or Maduro. And at the same time, I think from our primary perspective, you know, the United States, and it's more flagrant under Trump, but Obama had a very problematic Venezuela policy. Bush supported a coup, and obviously, you know, that there's an area where there's no disharmony inside the Trump administration. They're all synchronized and trying to, you know, position an oligarch government back in Venezuela, and that's probably first and foremost what Americans should have, or people in the United States should have their eyes on.
Yeah, totally. It's a state policy. I've been saying it for years that it didn't matter. You know, there was hope in Venezuela when Obama was elected. And I was like, are you guys nuts? It's a state policy.
Right.
You know, Obama's the one that started the sanctions against Venezuela, labeling the country an unusual and extraordinary threat to U.S. national security, which is ridiculous.
Right.
And now we've got Trump talking about a military invasion. So it's really just an escalation of an ongoing state policy where the end game is to regain control of the world's largest oil reserves. I mean, it's logical from a U.S. empire perspective. But, I think that people need to be cautious in the sense that, yes, the government is inherently flawed in Venezuela. This current government, there are authoritarian tendencies. You know, there are some violations of human rights going on. But on the other end, there are still a grassroots movement that's trying to push forward for a progressive social justice political project. And, you know, that, at least from my perspective, needs to be supported. And then at the same time, you know, coming from the U.S., I mean, the number one priority should be to speak out or just be aware of any, you know, further U.S. attempts to undermine Venezuelan sovereignty, because that's just unacceptable, you know, embarking on another war for oil in a country that's really just across our southern border. That is a democracy, regardless of, you know, the different threats against it today internally. There are people there who are honest and who are struggling for political processes on both sides, opposition, Chavista, whatever. So it's something that Venezuelans need to resolve. And should there be any outside involvement, it should come from Latin America. It should not come from the United States.
Ava Gollinger, I really, really appreciate your time. I hope to talk with you again soon.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thank you. Okay, everybody, we are going to go right to the fun half. That was went longer, but I think it's worthwhile. I'm still processing that. I mean, I think that it's a very tricky situation when you – and I want to hear more about the grassroots that still exists in Venezuela. Undoubtedly, as it presently is, the Maduro government, I mean, the project is a failure. I totally don't trust the opposition. And certainly the notion of a U.S. military intervention in there is insane and dangerous, not to mention the fact that we have continued through the whole process of working, you know, feverishly to undermine this government. So there's a lot of complexity to it. And I think that she, you know, obviously sympathetic to Chavez, but it's a pretty sophisticated perspective on it, which I'm just not seeing in many places in either direction. 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Join the Majority Report today. That's how this show happens. JustCoffee.coop. Get the Majority Report blend. Write a review of the Majority Report on iTunes. Obviously, also Patreon/TMBS for the Michael Brooks Show. 646-257-3920. The IMs are on. See you in the fun half. Back.